I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. It's the 200th anniversary of the birth of Canada's first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald, and a marvelous way of getting into his life and times is the book, Sir John's Table, The Culinary Life and Times of Canada's First Prime Minister. It's part biography, part social history of what Sir John A. ate and what people in what would become Canada ate. You see the cultural influences as well as the circumstances in which people cooked and ate. You see, too, how food shaped some of our history, political or otherwise. Linda Mashevsky, the book's author, joins me now. I'll get her to tell us about this culinary journey in history that she undertook to understand Macdonald's life and times. She is a freelance writer and food columnist. She wrote the book A Taste of Wintergreen. Her website is at lindymashevsky.com. The book is published by Goose Lane. Please welcome to the Plant Online program from her home in Kingston, Ontario today, Lindy Mashevsky. Ms. Mashevsky, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So you live in Kingston, is that right?
I do. I actually moved here in 2001, and I had been living in various places in the world, Australia and England and around Canada. And when I moved here, I really, for the first time, felt a huge visceral connection to Canada's history.
Sir John A. is a big deal there, I'm assuming. The sites of a sort.
He is. Yeah, he really is. And I think we feel his presence here. You know, I don't know if that's just a kind of crazy thinking on my part, but certainly I felt a lot more aware of Sir John A. Macdonald after I moved to Kingston.
So at first look at your book, we think it's some sort of, you know, novelty, some sort of recipe book even, about what Macdonald ate. But when you read the book, you really get a sense of the man, not only the history of this country and his, you know, whatever's going on in his life, but you get a sense of this place and what that was like in the 1800s. For you, why the entry by food in terms of looking at Macdonald's life?
Oh, okay, well, there's kind of a long answer to that, and the shortest answer I can give you is that I'm fascinated with food anyway, and I was already working as a food writer. I hadn't really considered to any large extent writing about culinary history, but I started to get interested in the history around Kingston and the beginnings of the country, and I began investigating to see if there was enough information to write about Sir John using the lens of food. I just find it a fascinating way to tell all kinds, like food is a fantastic way to tell people's life stories and to look at history. And, around the time when it was a couple of years ago when I got interested in this, the United Nations were designating this special cultural heritage designation to countries who had built up their food, their culinary history, and so they award this designation to France, Turkey, Mexico, and Japan. And I found it interesting. I thought, the interest worldwide in food and in culinary history is really growing. And the more I thought about it, the more important I thought it. A country can't be founded without food. It's such a vital part of our heritage, and yet. We didn't learn about it. Like in high school history class, we were lucky to hear about pemmican. And the irony is that 4 out of 5 settlers worked in food production. It was the mainstay of the economy. So not only were we busy feeding the nation and growing the food, but in fact, couldn't survive without it. So paramount.
Yeah, so the one of the early parts in your book is you talk about this journey that Macdonald's family took from, I guess, Scotland to come here. It's
right.
A terrible journey and terrible food on that ship.
Absolutely appalling. Those early ships were terrible, just awful. The Earl of Buckinghamshire is the boat that the Macdonald family came across on, and they traveled in steerage class. And there was 350 passengers on the boat. Most of them would have been in steerage. They had 2 privies on the ship. They had no running water in steerage. They had no fresh air, no light. It was just absolutely appalling conditions. And steerage class passengers were fed twice a day with these horrible rations that were doled out of a big kettle. So basically kind of watered down gruel for breakfast. And then later in the day, they would get a meal that was horse head stew or kind of stews made from the leftovers from the first and second class cabin. Really, really awful. I mean, they were all sick and had dysentery and respiratory infections and, you know, the crossing was just unbelievable.
And I guess Mrs. McDonald, because she's Scottish and practical, I guess, she brought along some food, didn't she?
She did, yeah. And it wasn't uncommon for stewage class passengers especially to bring food, but they were a little bit luckier than most that they'd had a store. The McDonald's had a store in Scotland, so she would have had some provisions to bring with her. And definitely she brought along, you know, things that would endure the journey, so and biscuits and bannock, things that could last. Because it's a six-week trip. Right? In fact, they were in transit for 9 weeks, because it was 6 weeks getting from across the Atlantic and into Quebec City, and then another 3 weeks coming down to St. Lawrence to Kingston in Upper Canada.
What was the food like once they get to what, I guess it was called Upper Canada, what would become Canada? I mean, was there a sort of Canadian cuisine, or was it just the influence, say, of the French and the English?
Well, it's interesting because there was certainly the influence of the French and the English. So, you know, particularly in Upper Canada, there was this kind of huge clan of Scottish people and English as well. And they had a diet that was kind of really heavily based in, like, what I would call stodge. So, you know, meat and potatoes and, you know, bread and carbohydrates, basically. And very few fruits and vegetables, but as the years went by, like as the decades went by, even in Sir John's life, that changed radically. And there were actually a surprising number of commodities that were available if you were wealthy enough to afford them. And McDonald's family would have been okay because they were shopkeepers, so they would have obviously had provisions from their store. But I was surprised when I started researching and looking at things like in the archives, I could find orders into the stores, and things like olive oil was available, and of course tea and anchovies and all kinds of spices, because the spice routes had opened up earlier. Sugar and raisins and even lemons and oranges were available as boat came in, because they knew enough by then to avoid scurvy. So, you know, so they would ship those whenever they were available. They would come in on the boat. But yeah, it was, you know, I think, well, life was very tough, and a lot of people, especially if you lived away from town and didn't have money, it was, you know, really hard going. But those people in town probably had a reasonable diet, and with each passing decade after McDonald's arrived in, 1815, there were significant changes.
What McDonald's tastes were you able to reveal in the course of your research? I mean, did you get a sense early on? I mean, we all know him as someone who liked to drink a lot, but just in terms of the food, are there, say, entries in journals, perhaps? I mean, I guess you can see that in the menus that would be prepared for him later on. But did you get a sense of what he liked?
I absolutely did, because he wrote a lot of letters, and his letters were all archived. And he would write about, he traveled to England fairly regularly, and he would write letters back to his mother about foods that he was enjoying. But while he was home, he was kind of a notorious light eater. He really liked fish. I think fish was a real staple in the diet. First of all, it was abundant in Upper Canada. Mm-hmm. It was abundant in Canada. Fish was abundant in Canada, period.
Yeah.
So they ate a lot of fish, and he really enjoyed fish. But, you know, he also enjoyed kind of, you know, the foods that had come, that his mother made, that he'd learned from his mother and had in his childhood. But, yeah, you get a sense as he gets older of his taste becoming quite, he goes from, you know, and this is my contention, actually, is that his life is this epic food story, because he goes from the Earl of Buckinghamshire, where he's having this horrendous food doled out of kettles, and you know, he's absolutely impoverished, to, by the end of his life, he's having dinner regularly with Queen Victoria or other members of the royal family, and Benjamin Disraeli, who was the British Prime Minister, at these lavish banquets. And certainly he had a taste for fine things, that's for sure.
Yeah, and there was also a spell when he lived in Montreal, is that right?
Yes, because the capital was temporarily in Montreal.
And he was in politics at that point?
Yes, he was. Yeah. So he just become a member of Parliament, and he thought that he was going to be in Kingston, and then Parliament was moved to Montreal. So he, he certainly, and he was by himself at this point in time because he left his family behind. So he'd be kind of in the taverns in Montreal drinking wine and eating tortillard and, eating French food and loving it.
Yeah, and in terms of what he liked to drink, I mean, we just assume because he's Scottish, he liked whiskey, but that's not the case, or?
Yeah, he actually wasn't much of a whiskey drinker, so he really liked red wine, drank a lot of red wine. He also had, quite a taste for champagne, and apparently he liked gin, and one of the reasons it's assumed that he liked gin is because he used to drink it wherever he was and have it's very handily disguised as a tumbler of water, so he'd have a tumbler of gin.
And the idea that I got in the book was that I guess everybody drank because you couldn't have water, I suppose.
Well, you could. I found this really interesting. I mean, first of all, whiskey was 25 cents a gallon and a nickel a glass, kind of a tumbler full in the time, which, I mean, it sounds ridiculously cheap, but it was cheap even then.
Yeah.
Water was almost much. And the thing about water was it carried pathogens. I mean, it was kind of more dangerous in some ways unless you had access to a lake or a clean river. But if you didn't, water was stored and carted. And, they didn't really have storage containers and sanitary methods that we would have now. So alcohol was safer. And the Victorian era, they self-medicated. They used alcohol. Queen Victoria's staff, even the lowest members of her staff, were allocated 8 pints of beer a day, and that was just the allocated ration.
And temperance, I guess, wasn't a thing yet, right?
In fact, yeah, temperance was just sort of rearing. It was rearing its head, the temperance movement. But again, Queen Victoria was very interesting on this. I mean, she actually threatened to demote clerics who promoted she was a very, like Sir John, she was a very devout drinker, and her favorite drink was red wine mixed half and half with Scotch whiskey.
That sounds interesting, so, yeah.
Yeah, imagine that drink.
Yeah. What the book also does, Sir John's Table, is gives us a sense of because we, as I told you at the beginning, I just assumed that people in this era ate like the folks that we see on Downton Abbey. But in those early years when MacDonald and his family are in Canada, the tools that were used, the methods of cooking, were quite primitive, weren't they?
Oh, incredibly primitive. So when the MacDonalds arrived, the first manufactured cast iron stove was still a decade off being built. And in fact, I think it was 1830 when the first cast iron stove was built in Upper Canada. Until then, people were just cooking in their hearths with iron pots. Mason jars had yet to be invented. They came a couple of decades later. There was very little there was few ways of storing anything at all. And, it was remarkably, remarkably difficult feeding a family. It was something that you would have been working at full time, not only just to procure the food, but to keep it safe and cook it. And, it's interesting to me now because one of the things that I think about when I'm cooking, it's just the sheer abundance of food that we have.
Yeah, and in those days, it took a while to get, basic staples. In terms of oysters, are they the same as they are now, or were they more safe to consume then? Or?
Well, I don't think they were more safe to consume. I think there were, problems that's just less well known. But they loved oysters. Victorians absolutely loved oysters. In fact, they loved them so much they depleted the entire eastern seabed of oysters. For a while there, in the early years of canning, they were trying to can oysters. And they had some. I mean, it was terrible rounds of food poisoning happened with that. So that was abandoned for some time. But what they did was they shipped these oysters to the East Coast in sand, and then they kept them watered, and they carted oysters all the way across the country, and this happened in both the United States and in Canada. And it's there were taverns where sort of oyster bars where they would serve alcohol and oysters, and that was a huge, huge taste for them.
In terms of McDonald's taste for oysters, I mean, right up to the end, he enjoyed them, right? I guess they'd be raw, would they?
Well, actually, they served oysters predominantly cooked.
Oh, I see.
Because that would have been safer. But yeah, I think he also did consume raw oysters. It just wasn't as popular. And for sure, he ate oysters right up to the end. There's a scene in the book, actually, where McDonald has become the prime minister, and he's quite sick. And he actually turns out that his gallbladder is blocked. He's in the House of Commons in Ottawa in his office when he crashes to the floor having convulsions, and the doctor is summoned. And at some point along the way, the doctor tells him that the hopes of the nation are depending on him, and that he has to take all this very seriously, and that he's only allowed to have half an oyster as a special treat. And McDonald says to this, "It seems strange. The hopes of Canada depend on half an oyster."
The female influence. I mean, we've talked about his mother, but his wives. I guess they would do most of the cooking, wouldn't they?
Well, I think both of his wives actually were quite inadequate cooks, and that was quite interesting. So by the time his second wife came along, after his first wife died, by that point he's a little bit wealthier and they're able to afford some help. So they have cooks, especially for meals where people are coming in. But, you know, they were both kind of inadequate in the kitchen, and it's really interesting because McDonald had a lifelong friend, Eliza Grimason, who was a poor Irish woman who actually, well, she started life very poor, and she owned a tavern in Kingston, and he would eat there quite often. They were terrific friends. She used to supply food for his events, for his political events, and looked after him much of his life. She was apparently a fabulous cook. So at least he had that.
Yeah, yeah. And there are recipes in the book, these would be things that would be consumed. I guess it'd be common during the era, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So I chose recipes that came from books from the era, uh-huh. And that were available to Canadian households. And I tried to choose things that were like popular then, but that are still feasible to make.
So you tried making them?
I made everything in the book, yes.
Go ahead, pardon.
Sorry, some of them are more satisfactory than others, but
yeah,
yes,
I'll bet.
Make everything.
Yeah. There's a remedy in here for hysteria.
Oh, yes.
Did you try that?
No, I didn't actually try the remedy. I may have to yet, but no, I haven't tried those.
It's a marvelous look into what, I guess, concerns people at the time, and sort of what, you know, I mean, why are people hysterical in that era, and what they thought would work?
Yeah, well, you know, I think hysteria was a common expression for any kind of anxiety or depression or, you know, any
stress,
mental illness, stress, exactly, and their lives were pretty stressful. So if they weren't drinking, and they had very few means to self-medicate.
Yeah.
So, you know, they didn't have Tylenol, they didn't have the things we turn to. They certainly didn't have tranquilizers. They had morphine, opium, and alcohol, basically. So they had some marijuana, too, apparently, but it's less prevalent in the colonies than it was in places like England.
Sir Richard Gwynne. He's not Sir Richard Gwynne. He's just Richard Gwynne.
He should be, sir.
He should, yeah, because, I mean, those two marvelous books on McDonald, opened up a lot of interest in him. When he was on for those two books, he said that, you know, just how indispensable Sir John A. was to this country, that if there was no Sir John A., there wouldn't be a Canada. And, you know, I get that sense again reading your book. I mean, he's a figure that unfortunately a lot of people only know from seeing his face on our money.
But
for you, having looked at what he ate and looking at this life as you have in the course of writing this book, you do get that sense, don't you, that he was the indispensable man?
I really believe he was. I think he did get things wrong, of course, and, you know, the colonial era, there were different problems. There were serious issues, serious mistreatment of First Nations people in the country and of migrant workers.
Yeah.
But I do believe that Canada would not exist if it were not for Sir John A. Macdonald. He was such a driving force in the early years of this nation. And he was so strong. He was so, you know, he's so firm in his convictions. And at his side, he had George Etienne Cartier for a good portion of that time. And they were, you know, they were probably the strongest political duo that Canada has ever seen.
Yeah.
And they, you know, yeah, I absolutely, so I think Richard Gwynne had that part of the argument absolutely right, that it was highly likely that great tracts of land would have been sold to the United States if it wasn't for McDonald and Pell.
And you know, when you look at, because there have only been 24 prime ministers, and, you know, maybe some of the early ones were just as fascinating, but Macdonald seems to be the more fascinating of those 23 men and one woman that have been Prime Minister of Canada. Just looking at their food, right?
He's such a character. He was just a flamboyant character. I really didn't know so much about him before I started doing the research. I mean, the first thing I did was read six biographies.
Uh-huh.
Including Richard Gwynne's biography, but I, you know, and then I moved on from there into archives. But what I found was this intensely human man who really, I mean, it's often been said of him that people loved him because he loved people. But he was this man who, you know, there's so many examples of him crossing the party lines to look after people on the other side. He cared about everybody. So I think, you know, the place where he fell down and where he's taking a bit of flak now, quite a lot of flak now, is, you know, what happened when he put the railway across the country.
Yeah.
And you know, Indigenous people starved to death after the demise of the Bison herd. And, it is a huge dark spot in our history. And unfortunately, I think it was kind of consensus in the colonial era. We voted for him six times. He wasn't a dictator, so this was consensus of public opinion.
Yeah.
But, I do think he was a remarkable man. I do think that we kind of owe our nation good to him.
You must have seen that story last week about the chef at 24 Sussex having been dismissed.
Right.
Yeah, and it was just fascinating to see some of there was talk of some of the food that he prepared for the Harpers while they were there. And
right.
And again, it makes the point that Sir John A. led a more fascinating culinary life, didn't he, than anyone since?
I think so. I really think he did. He was quite an adventuresome guy. And one thing that I really believe about Sir John A. is that he always understood the connection between love and food and, you know, bringing people together.
Mm-hmm.
He really got that.
And he used that to his political advantage a number of times.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I find it really interesting that they had those campaign picnics that were so lavish.
Yeah.
And, you know, now you'd be lucky to get coffee in a styrofoam cup, but they threw those massive events and brought together, you know, peat farmers and people from town. And they would be all-day events, you know, where they would have these lavish, huge meals. Basically, kind of a party. That's obviously so far gone now, but it was a different era. But food was very important.
This is, Lindy, a wonderful book, and congratulations on it, and continued good luck with it. I appreciate your time today. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Me too. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. The website for more, lindymashevsky.com. The book is called Sir John's Table, The Culinary Life and Times of Canada's First Prime Minister. It's published by Goose Lane. It's author Lindy Mashevsky joined me on the line from Kingston, Ontario, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.